104.
Hello, good morning. It's 11:05. It's Heavy 104 on Sunday morning. And of course, that means it's Folk Tales with me, Terry Bennett. And in the studio today, my guest is Simon Frankovich. Is that correct pronunciation,
completely
first of all?
Correct. Well done, Terry. Very good.
And what's the origin of your surname?
It's Polish.
Polish.
My surname is Polish. My grandfather and grandmother came here after the Second World War.
Right.
And my father was born in a very humble refugee camp in Wales.
Okay.
So we have humble beginnings.
And Simon, you are, well, what should we say, an optician by trade, but also qualified in orthoptics.
Correct.
Tell us what the difference is.
Of course, yeah. Orthoptics, it's a Greek word, means straight eyes, and it's the study of squints and lazy eyes. So our typical customer would be someone who's 2 or 3 years old with a turn in their eye, or somebody who's much older, who's developed double vision due to sort of a problem with the nerves supplying the muscles to the eyes.
And this is something you've done throughout your professional career.
Mm-hmm.
So as well as being an optician, you've also got a deep interest in music, I know.
Indeed.
And a certain band locally.
Yes, a band that's been around for a couple of years called Flatland Boogie Band. And the guitarist, one of the guitarists is a person by the name of Taff Martin. I don't know if anyone's ever heard of him.
The name is
before, but
strangely familiar.
Yeah. Yes,
and but apart from that, you've also got an interest in charity work, which we're going to explore later.
Absolutely.
Through something called the Akamba Aid
Fund. The Akamba Aid Fund, that's right. Yes.
And that provides relief to communities in
East Africa, in the Akamba tribal people in East Africa.
Okay.
Sorry, in eastern Kenya, rather, in Africa.
Right. And this is something, again, you've become involved in through your professional life.
That's right. Accidentally got involved probably 10 years ago now. And so I'll explain all about that due course.
Well, we'll get into it all in a moment, but we'll take your first track first, which is a good idea, isn't it?
Indeed.
What is your first track?
My first track is by a band called Tower of Power. Anyone who knows me knows that if you chopped my arm off, you'd probably find the words Tower of Power written inside it. They're a band founded nearly 50 years ago in San Francisco, and there are still 5 of the original members in the band. They're playing in the UK next week. I'm so excited to be going. This song is called What Is Hip?
Okay, let's have the track.
Exactly sure what's him. Started to let your hair go.
That's Tower of Power there with What Is Hip from 1973, actually from their Tower of Power album, which I'm reliably told was their third and most successful album to date. In the studio, I have Simon Frankovich, who is most known, I suppose, for being an optician. It's Robert Frith in Yeovil, isn't it?
That's right, yes.
So you're one of the partners there?
Yes, have been for the last 12 years, amazingly. I can't quite believe it, but yes, been living in the West Country since 2005. And enjoying every minute of it.
We'll come back and talk about the professional side in a minute, but where were you born?
I was born in Surrey. I was actually born in Epsom, but lived my formative years in a little place called Woodminster near Banstead. And I was brought up there with my mum and dad, my sister, my younger sister Lisa, who always was and always will be a pain, but I love her dearly, nonetheless. And it was just a great time, really, really happy times. We've always been a very close family and always done lots of things together. I think it was one of these situations, as you get older, you realise that we weren't a family of means. We didn't have much money when we were younger, but we didn't know that. We always went on great holidays. They might only have been a caravan holiday down on the south coast, but to us that was living the dream. It was wonderful. So I have very, very fond memories of my time growing up.
Lovely. And I always ask mum and dad's occupations whether they had any influence in the direction that you took.
No, none whatsoever. I was the first person in my family to do A-levels or go to university. And my father worked in the motor industry. And my mother, for most of my years, was a stay-at-home mum, was the house builder, if you like, the home builder. And it had a number of jobs in various professions, including the immigration service. As we grew older. But no, I don't quite know how I ended up going down the route that I did.
There was a musical inheritance, though, I believe, isn't there?
Oh, there was indeed, yes, certainly. My dad was in a band just always. That's just what dad did. On a Friday and Saturday night, dad would go off and be in his band. And so just music was always on in the house. We always had some sort of thing going on in the house. But it was when I was about 8 years old that his piano player from his band gave him a three-quarter size guitar and said, "Oh, would your son like to have this?" And, "Oh, okay, give it a go." So we had it strung and I've never looked back, really. I had my first guitar lessons when I was 8 years old. Almost gave up on the first lesson because I couldn't play the chord G. I don't know if you've ever tried to play the chord G, but when you're eight, it's quite a hard chord to play. And I was encouraged to go back and have another try, and I did, and I'm pleased I did, because music has become a big part of my life all the way through from 8 years old.
Lovely. So you went to school up around Epsom area?
In Woodminster, yeah. So we went to the village school.
And then on to senior school.
Mm-hmm.
Enjoy school days?
I think so, yeah. I was never the popular kid. I was always the geek. I had a very small circle of friends, and we just got on with each other really well and still get on with each other now, but I was always the last person to be picked for rugby or cricket or whatever, and just didn't really care what anyone thought. It was wonderful. I'm so pleased that I didn't have that ability to worry about what people thought about me, because I used to love trains and would go train spotting and would be delighted, and for me that was living the dream. But my colleagues at school just thought I was a bit of an idiot and just left me alone. It was wonderful. And it was only really after leaving school, I think, that I flourished academically. I was lucky to go to a very good school, a grammar school in Wallington. And it was just a given that you were going to go to university. So from the age of 10, 11, I was going to be a brain surgeon. That's what I was going to do. That was my future. And I'm not a brain surgeon. I didn't quite get the A-level grades that I needed to be a brain surgeon. But again, I don't mind that. I'm quite happy that my life didn't take me down that route.
So you felt able really to resist peer pressure, and you did what you wanted to do at school.
Yes.
And you were who you wanted to be. Mm-hmm. So you got to a point where you needed to start considering what happened after school. And the idea was then to go into medicine, was it?
It was indeed, yes. So I'd spent all of my schooling believing that I was going to go to medical school. And my teachers had said, you need to have a fallback option just in case it doesn't work. I think they knew. And I was, I'm determined, I'm going to get there. So when I failed to get into medical school, it was a bit of a wake-up call. So I got a job in a University College hospital in London. It so happened my best friend's dad worked in the haematology department there, and so he got me a job. And what I figured I would do is, rather than resit my A-levels, I would get a job in a medical profession to show how dedicated I was. And I used to do things like playing my guitar at the local hospice and just to do all these medical things that I could possibly try. And I applied again to get into medical school. I got an interview for a place on a waiting list to go to Charing Cross Hospital Medical School, and I failed to get that place either. So I think somebody was trying to tell me, look somewhere else. And it was only fortunate that while I was in the department in London, that somebody took me under her wing and showed me different professions. They showed me radiography, radiotherapy, and orthoptics. And it was there that I just thought, I can get this, I like this. And that's where I went next.
Right, so you left school, and you had various odd jobs, I think you said to me.
My Saturday job was in a music shop in the one of the biggest music shops in the south of England called Rock Bottom in West Croydon. And I got a job at the age of 15 as the Saturday boy, the tea maker, the person who dusted the guitars. I was paid the princely sum of £10 a day to work there, and it was wonderful. It was a completely different awakening of another way of life, I suppose. I used to turn up to work in a shirt and tie, and the manager there had to say, I think you need to kind of dress down a little bit. You're working in a music shop.
Is this your geeky side still coming through?
Yeah, absolutely. And I was still this geek, but they loved me for it. And rather than mocking me, they embraced it. And I grew up a lot there. It was great fun.
And after the music school, after the music shop, I think you said something about photographic studio.
Yeah, that's right. My very, very first job when I left school was, again, through a friend whose brother owned a photographic studio in Wandsworth. And this was taking photographs for things you could buy with Benson & Hedges points. So if you were wanting to smoke yourself to death, what better way to encourage you to do that than to give you points for killing yourself? And you could spend those points in a bit like the Argos catalogue. So I would help set up the photographs for them to shoot in the catalogue. And it was just, again, fascinating. Just a really interesting way of life. But I knew I didn't want to go down that route. This was just a stepping stone.
You came then to work in the hospital, you're saying. So how did that come about?
Well, the orthoptics profession is... it's a 3-year degree course, and that was at Liverpool University. So I spent my sort of first time away from home up in Liverpool. And as part of that, you work in various hospitals around the country, gain your experience, and then work in a hospital. So it's not like an optician. You don't have a high street orthoptist. You don't go and get your double vision fixed in Squint Savers or something like that. It's not quite how it works. I think my time at Liverpool was another awakening. It was understanding how I learn, and I hadn't got that at school. It probably sounds like a bit of a strange thing, but revising for exams, I would just write out everything again rather than trying to compress it in a different way. And it was my first term at university, I thought, I get this now. And I almost wish I'd had the chance to take my A-levels again, knowing how I could have stored that information better. But they were three fantastic years. It was an amazing city, being away from a very suburban south of England upbringing where everything is London-centric. There were people in my class who'd never been to London. I couldn't get my head around how you could be 20 and never have been to London. And it was a great way of growing up and trying different things. It was a lovely time.
Do you look back on the school times and think in some ways that they failed you through not identifying your particular learning style?
Probably, yeah. It was a very orthodox, didactic sort of teaching environment. And I remember clearly my physics teacher, I just thought I was a complete aberration and a pain in his class because I just couldn't understand things. And I'd go to him asking for help, and he would just hold his head in his hands and say, oh, Frankovic. And he would despair, and that really didn't do much for my self-esteem. So I didn't do well in physics, funnily enough. But I don't mind that. Again, had I excelled at school, I probably would have gone into medical school. I probably would be a very stressed-out brain surgeon right now, and I might have that house that I wanted, I might have the car that I wanted, but I wouldn't have the quality of life I do now. I know that.
And going to university for many people is a bit of a life-changing moment. And it sounds like it was for you as well, not just in terms of the learning bits, but moving away from home and a different city and away from, as you say, away from the southeast.
It was, I think, as probably more of a wrench for my parents than it was for me, because I was the one going on this journey and it was great and amazing fun. But I'll never forget my first like going up to university the night before I started. So I had come up all the way up from our home near Croydon and arrived in Liverpool, and I lived on a cobbled street on a house that used to be a shop that had a steel front door and bars on the windows. And my parents had to leave me in this house. At that particular time, there was no gas or electricity supply in the house. My windows were boarded up, and they had to drive away knowing that they left me, their firstborn son, in this broken city. It was just all part of this amazing journey. I lived in a house with eight people. We had no neighbours. It was just a party atmosphere the whole time. It was chaos.
But you still managed to get a degree out of it.
I did, I still did well in spite of all of that. But it needed to happen. I remember my lecturer saying, "You've got to get the balance between work and play right." And I think I did that. I think I just about managed that.
All right. Let's take the next track, shall we? And then we'll go on and talk a little bit about life after university. Mm-hmm. So this is by Space.
Yes, a Liverpool band, funnily enough. And I found my time at Liverpool was sort of shut off as a distant memory until February this year, where I took my family up to the city. I wanted to show my children where I went to university. And there was a real clash of worlds. And I was standing outside the pub on campus that I used to spend a lot of time and drink a lot of beer with my two children. And that was a really weird moment. And this album, this Space album called Tin Planet, is just like that. I used to listen to it at university, but it's now become the sort of anthem for us when we go on holiday. It will always remind me of our trips down to Falmouth. And so I asked my children which song I should choose from the album, and my daughter Sophie said it should be this one here called The Ballad of Tom Jones.
The Ballad of Tom Jones it is, by Space.
What did I do wrong?
Boy, you nearly drove me cuckoo.
Am I really all that bad?
You're worse than Hannibal Lecter, Charlie Manson, Freddy Krueger.
Why are we still together?
Oh, I can't leave you till you're dead.
You mean till death do us part?
I mean like cyanide strangulation or an axe to your head.
It was lucky for us I turned the radio on.
They say that music soothes the savage beast.
Voice that stopped you seeing red. The two of us would surely have ended up dead. You stopped us from killing each other. You'll never know that you saved our lives.
I've never thrown my knickers at you.
And I don't come from Wales. Still haven't solved our problem.
You mean we hate each other's guts.
Still wanna poison your pizza.
And I still wanna cut off your nets.
I phoned the marriage guidance.
I tied the phone line round your neck.
I'm sick of all this hatred.
Oh, that'll be the arsenic making you sick.
You were about to drive me over the edge of a cliff.
As I tried to jump out and up the stereo wall,
you changed your mind and then slammed on the brake. Lucky for us, we brought his greatest hits. You stopped us from killing each other. You'll never know, but you saved our lives.
I've never thrown my knickers at you.
And I don't
That's The Ballad of Tom Jones by Space with Kerry Matthews, who's the lead singer of Catatonia. And that got to number four in the UK in March 1998. My guest in the studio is Simon Frankovich. And Simon is an optician now in Yeovil. And we're going to move on and talk about that in a moment. But we got to the point, Simon, where you'd left university in Liverpool. And you then had to go and find some paid employment, I suppose.
Yeah, it's time to stop being a sponging student, as my family would remind me. And the orthoptics degree is structured in a way that, as I think I said, you spend time travelling around the UK to work in different hospitals. And as soon as you then pass your degree, you can practice straight away. And that had the great advantage of having probably 8 or 9 different job interviews over that 3-year period. You could suss out hospitals that you might want to work in, or indeed those that you don't want to work in. And I realised very quickly I would never want to work at the Coventry and Warwick Hospital. It was not a good experience there. But I had a fantastic experience in my placement in Reading. And that was towards the end of my degree. So at the end of your, when you get your degree, you then start to look for jobs. And a job became available at the Royal Berks Hospital. So I went for it. And I got it. Apparently, I got it on the merits of the fact that I said I could make a damn good cup of tea. And that is very important. Anyone who knows an orthoptist will know that cups of tea are very, very important. So, I got the job.
Apart
there.
Apart from it was, making the tea, what was the job? It was an orthoptist.
It was as an orthoptist, yeah. So, as I've explained, dealing with children with squints and lazy eyes. Yeah. But you have to be able to make a good cup of tea at the same time. And that was another pivotal point in my life, because I met some very important people. The most important, I would say, is my wife, Louise. She was working at the hospital, and I was staying in the staff accommodation, the nursing home across the road. And also in the nursing accommodation was a good friend of mine, Becky, who is an orthoptist, who I worked with and still work with now. And her husband, Ben, is my business partner. And he and I worked together during my placement. So when I came to Reading, he was working at the hospital, and I shudder to say it, but he's a decent chap, and we just sort of hit it off straight away. He would finish my jokes, and it was really annoying that was my joke. How did you know where that joke was going? And we have a very, very similar sense of humour, and we always sort of said it would be great to work together. So he left the department. I got his job as he left. And he left the department to go to university to study optometry. And I'd already had an idea that that's what I wanted to do. So 2 years down the line, I went to City University to study optometry, following in his footsteps. In that time, Becky moved in with my wife. So they lived together. And we've always been in very, very close contact with each other. So, my time at Reading was packed with very, very happy memories indeed. Another big thing that I did was join a band, because music was a big part of my life. So as soon as I'd settled in Reading, worked out that's where I was going to be, I put an advert in the local music shop and was approached by a guy called Jeremy. And we got a band together called Funk Said Sophie. And it was a 5, depending on how lucky we were, 5 or 6, maybe sometimes 7 or 8 piece band. And we just played the music we absolutely love. So jazz funk music, everything from Starsky and Hutch through to Diamonds Are Forever. It was a wonderful, wonderful time. We never got hardly any gigs, but it was great. We did it for fun. And it was a very important part of being in Reading.
And you met Louise, as you say.
I did.
When you were working there. Mm-hmm. Was she also in optometry? Or?
No. I suppose she could have an honorary degree in both orthoptics and optometry, given the number of eye conversations she has to listen to. But she's a nurse. And so she was, she was working at the hospital, lived in the same accommodation as Becky. I thought, yeah, I quite like the look of you. And here we are today, a happy marriage with 2 children.
Splendid. So you decided while you were at that posting that you wanted to do optometry rather than orthoptics.
Lots of O's.
Yes, absolutely. There are. So how did you make that happen? You presumably needed additional qualifications for that.
Indeed, yes. So optometry is a different degree. And what should have happened is I should have gone back to university for 3 years. But I was fortunate enough to negotiate not doing the first year at university. And there are many places that you can study optometry in the UK. I really only wanted to go to London or possibly a couple of other places, but the other places I applied to were flatly refused to do anything other than a three-year degree course. And by this time, tuition fees had come in. It was going to be a very expensive venture to go and do this. But I was fortunate enough that my business partner, Ben, had been through the optometry degree in 2 years. So precedent had been set. And therefore, I simply spoke to the admissions tutor and said, why could he do it and I can't do it? And in that one phone call, I saved a lot of money, an awful lot of money. So he said, yeah, OK, we'll let you in the second year. And that's what I did. So I joined a third of the way into the course, had to make new friends very quickly.
This was in London?
In London, that's right, City University, which is just off the Goswell Road in the heart of London. And that was a very different learning experience because I knew how much each lecture cost. I was attending 100% of my lectures. I was not there to have a party. I was there to work and work hard. I'd already set a benchmark for how well I could do a degree, and I needed to make sure I could do at least that well. So I was, again, being a geek, and I had to do well. But yeah, it was a very different, but I needed to go through that process, and it was a thoroughly in-depth and enjoyable learning experience. The orthoptics degree, you learned about eyes, but many other medical things as well. Optometry was just eyes, everything. And it's something I absolutely love. So, yeah, to do that for 2 years, I enjoyed every minute.
And at the end of that, you came away with a further degree then.
I did.
But that still doesn't make you an optician.
No, there's yet another hurdle that you have to go through to become an optometrist, which is that you have to do a pre-qualification or pre-registration year. So unlike orthoptics, where you do that mashed up all through the degree, admittedly, doing that, you don't get any holidays. In optometry, you get lovely long holidays, which enables you to go and work as an orthoptist, in my case. But you then had to do a year of work. So by this time, Louise had moved away from Reading and had got a job in Basingstoke. So I moved in with her and got a job in Southampton. Had to commute on the 727 to Southampton every day, 5 days a week, even Saturdays. And needed to go through that, that process of being trained, working under supervision, and then doing my exams. And then when that was finished, I had my ticket to practice, and I was let loose on the public.
So that was a year's worth of pre-qualification?
That's right, yeah. It was around a year, yeah. That's right.
I see. And you were still living in Reading, Basingstoke?
In Basingstoke. Yeah. So by that time, yeah, so our ties with Reading had finished and moved out to Basingstoke. And after qualification, I decided, well, maybe I need to formalise our relationship a little bit more. So we had a celebratory trip to New York, and whilst walking around Central Park, just by the John Lennon Memorial, I proposed to Louise. And yes, she didn't say no. This is a point of contention. She's never actually said yes, she'd marry me, but she didn't say she wouldn't, and she went ahead with it. So I'm assuming that was an implied yes.
I think she'd have trouble arguing against it.
I'd say so now, in a court, yes, absolutely. Yeah.
OK, that's probably a good moment to have our next track, which is Elton John this time. Tell us about this.
It is, yeah. Well, this of all the tracks that I was going to choose, this was probably the easiest one because this was our first dance. And we didn't want to tell anyone that we didn't tell anyone we were doing this. We had dancing lessons for about 3 months beforehand. And so people just thought, oh, this is their first dance. And we broke into a choreographed cha-cha-cha, which was a great satisfaction. But this song is called Are You Ready for Love?
Are You Ready for Love? And it's by Elton John.
If you let me love you, let me love you. don't let me go. Just say it so. We'll hear the music ring from the mountaintops to the valley below us. We'll serenade the world with a lullaby so the angels will know us. Angels will know us. Are you ready? Are you ready for love? Yes, I am. Oh, yeah. Are you ready? Are you ready for love? Yes, I am.
That's Elton John, and he's ready for love. That was 1977. It's actually wasn't released until a couple of years after that, but got to number one in the UK around about that time. In the studio, my guest today is Simon Frankovich, who's currently now an optician in Yeovil. But we've been running through your life, Simon, which sort of started up in Epsom, didn't it? And then you went to university in Liverpool and then London, and then you did some practice for practice, as it were, in Southampton.
Yep.
That's about where we've got to, isn't it? So you're now a qualified optometrist.
Indeed.
Or an optician. Is there a difference between those two terms?
There is a difference, yeah. There's different types of optician. You could be a dispensing optician or an ophthalmic optician. And a dispensing optician is the person who fits optical appliances like spectacles or sometimes contact lenses, but is not allowed by law to test sight. And an ophthalmic optician does that and can test people's sight. And an optometrist is an ophthalmic optician. So okay. It's just saying which one of those you are. So I am both an optician and an optometrist.
Right, I see. So you're now qualified anyway, and
yes.
Living at that time in Basingstoke. So
yes.
How did you come to be in Yeovil? Yeovil was your first professional practice, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. It was just life takes you on a series of weird journeys. And during my degree, I worked at a Saturday job in an optician's in Farnham. And there was somebody in the practice who just really did not like me, and I could not understand what the problem was. But when this person's your line manager, it made a very difficult working condition. And I was due to do my training, my pre-qualification training in that practice. That didn't work, and I was put in the practice in Southampton. And while I was there, the practice manager, who was there for a six-month period, left and became the general manager of Robert Frith Optometrists. And he and I always said it would be good to work together again. And one day I got a phone call out of the blue saying, I've got a practice for sale down in Somerset. Do you fancy coming on board? And it was a big undertaking. It was the practice in Yeovil, which at the time was in the Queedam Centre. And that was a big investment to make. And I just couldn't do it on my own. So I said, well, I can't do it myself. However, I could get my business, this mate of mine, Ben, we might like to do this venture together. And that wasn't enough of, there was sort of too much of us for the investment. So another practice came along in Chard and we packaged the two together. So he and I bought in as directors of Robert Frith's in Yeovil and in Chard. And we took a bit of a punt and packed everything up. And it was just at the time that Becky was pregnant with her first, with their first child. And that all happened at the same time. And it was just, I always saw my life as quite a roller coaster. There'd been many twists and turns to it. And this was just the next phase, the next section of that roller coaster, because we really didn't know what we were doing. As in coming to the West Country, we had no ties down here at all. I honestly thought Yeovil was in Wiltshire when I first moved down here. It was a surprise that it was in Somerset. And we found a place called Crewkerne. That's how we call it. Apparently it's called Crooken, halfway between Yeovil and Chard. And that seemed the right place to kind of set down our roots. And so we did. We bought a house in Crewkerne, and for 10 years we lived there. It was wonderful. So we could stroll into town. We had everything that we needed there. And it was a lovely place for us to start our family as well. So shortly after we moved to Somerset, we had our first daughter, Lucy. And a couple of years later, Sophie came along. And within about 6 months of us moving down to Somerset, my parents came to visit. And, well, within a month or so, they came to visit. And you could see them thinking, why are we living near Croydon? We could be down here. We could be near the seaside. We could be in the countryside. And so by that Christmas, they'd sold up, moved down. And, yeah, they still live there still live there now. So it was a relocation for everyone, the whole Frankovich clan, sort of moving down to the West Country.
That's great.
And we've never looked back.
And you took over two existing optician businesses. Mm-hmm. So how did you split that? Did one of you go to one and one to the other?
Yeah, they were very differently sized. So the thought had been that one would have one and one would have the other. But I'm pleased we didn't do that because the burden of work is so vastly different. They're two very, very, very different towns. And they're like having two children. They have very different needs. And I think it's fair to say that the businesses when we took them over were floundering a little bit, particularly the practice in Yeovil. It lacked any sort of direction. It had it tested probably one clinic 3-4 days a week, and there were a lot of costs associated with being where we were in the town centre. So it took a lot of work to build up a reputation, and I'd like to think that our tenets of being good at what we do, delivering high quality service, high quality products with a team of people that really love their jobs, it has begun to make some changes for us. And so after about 7 years of being in the Queedam Centre, we decided to relocate to Princes Street, and that was again another big shift in our business, because that opened our business up to a lot of people who would never have shopped in the Queedam Centre, who would have shopped elsewhere, didn't know that we were ever in the town. So we instantly got a lot busier. And 18 months ago, we had the opportunity to acquire another part of our business, which is the opticians that used to be Hart's Opticians on Princes Street, who were our neighbours for a while. And yes, their business came up for sale. And I think Ben and I looked at each other thinking, yeah, we've got another 20 years of us in here, 20 years of work in us. Let's take on this challenge. And it did prove to be an unbelievable challenge.
Good.
But it's, I think we can look back now and say it was the best thing we did. So we now test 6 days a week. Most days we have four clinics running. It's a much, much bigger organisation than it was, but hopefully still maintaining those same principles of excellent quality of care and, yeah, people who are enthusiastic about what they do.
The business has expanded then quite a lot.
Hugely so, hugely. We had to start with maybe 5 or 6 employees. I've now got 20, 25 people that we employ, which is, it itself comes with some challenges.
Of course.
As an employer of people, you realise that the hardest part of my job is that, definitely. Give me a complicated pair of eyes any day. I can deal with that very easily. But, yeah, it's people come with their own baggage, I think.
I feel there could be another hour's worth of this programme just talking about that.
Less said about that, the better, I think.
So the Chard business continues to thrive?
Indeed it does, yeah. Yes. Chard, and as I said, they're like two children, and they both have... They're excellent in their own ways, and Chard has just gradually built up again and again, but we've got such a strong, stable team of people down there, and yeah, it just ticks on really nicely. It's the place that has caused me few problems and few issues.
That's good. And in the background, of course, your musical interests continue. Mm-hmm. Through all of this, tell us about them.
Yes, well, I suppose music having been such a big part of my life, it was sort of on one of those terms and conditions when I married Louise, was to say that this is going to be something I'm going to do. You have to understand that. And as soon as we moved to Somerset, within possibly a week or two, I went to Pete Wright's Music in Yeovil and just said, I'm a bass player looking for a band. Do you know anyone who's looking for someone? And I was given the phone number of somebody called Taff Martin. And I gave him a call, had an audition, and the rest is history. And I'm regularly reminded of the fact that I'm the longest-serving bass player in Flatland Boogie Band. Everyone else has got to about 3 years of service, and I'm currently 12 and a bit years of service. So always waiting to be sacked any minute now. I'm always waiting for that P45 to come through the door. But it has been... That was wonderful. It was a type of music I'd never really played before. And I think it's fair to say I've learnt to love the music that we play. And after about a year of joining the band, the drummer left, and we needed to have some percussion. So I suggested, well, how about my dad? He's now in the area. He's not played for a few years. He retired a few years ago, but maybe he could come along and play with us for a bit. And yes, that was 11 years ago. So he's still in the band to this day.
The band is worth just discussing now. The band has decided to finally hang up your guitar strings or whatever it may be in a couple of weeks' time, hasn't it?
Indeed it is, yeah.
Why so?
I'd love to say it's because we all hate each other and there's artistic differences, but that's not true. I think we love playing, but I think we can see that we need to stop while the going's good. A couple of people in the band have ailments that makes it harder for them to play, and quite rightly, I think they want to stop while they can still play well. I mean, some would argue that they can't still play well, but you know that's moot point. But I think it was a decision we took so we could enjoy the last gigs and make sure that they were all really good fun. Anyone who's a gigging musician will know that some venues you play are wonderful and others you just think, get me out of here, I don't want to be here. And we just wanted to plan our final year and just choose the cherry pick the best venues. So with a heavy heart indeed, Friday the 20th of October is our final gig, which will be at the Digby Hall in Sherborne. And we encourage anyone to come along. It's going to be a great musical extravaganza.
Tickets are available, aren't they?
Tickets are indeed available, yes.
From Oliver's in Sherborne and probably many other places too.
I've no doubt there are many outlets, and Taff will kill me for not having remembered where those outlets are, but tickets are a princely sum of £5 and it will be worth every penny.
Well, I have to say, the Flatland Boogie Band is a very professional organisation and they produce a wonderful sound. And
who wrote that?
That's from Taff. He's just
emailed me. Okay, fine. Yeah. Okay.
And your next track is by said band, isn't it?
It is, yes. I think we decided, again, a couple of years ago that while we were in the zone, if you like, while it was all sounding good, let's get some of this down and recorded. So we went to a recording studio down near Bridport with a friend of ours in his studio, and we put down 7 tracks. And this is one of them. This is by Clyde McFlutter. Yes, Clyde McFlutter, and it's called Lover Please.
It's a great track, let's have it.
Lover, please come back. Don't take a train coming down the track. Just as bad.
That's a great track. That is the Flatland Boogie Band with Lover Please, featuring Simon Frankovich on bass guitar.
Indeed.
And we were just chatting while that was on. One of your favourite tracks from the band, then?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it sort of epitomises what I like about the music that we play and the feel that the band has got. It will be hard to play with another group to get that groove again. As you know, I've played in a lot of different groups. I joined a group in Liverpool that didn't really have any great groove to it. I first started playing when I was 14 with my dad in his dinner dance band. And so to be able to play with him again has been a great privilege. And I think what I'll find difficult is finding a drummer that I can lock onto the groove with. I know it's out there, but it would take a little while to find. So
what's your game plan after the 20th of October? Are you actively seeking another band?
I will have a few months off enjoying being able to do what normal people do on a Friday and Saturday night, watching the telly, going out, going around to friends' houses. I will be able to do something on New Year's Eve this year that doesn't involve staying up till 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. It will be wonderful. So I'm going to enjoy that, and then I'll be looking around and seeing what's out there. But I'll definitely play again. There's no doubt about that at all.
Okay. We've dealt with your professional career and the fact that you formed this very successful Opticians in Yeovil, or took it over and built it up, and Branch in Chard. But running again in the background alongside the band activity is your charity work. And this is with the Acamba Aid Fund. Mm-hmm. What do they do, and how did you get involved with that?
I've already said that life takes you on funny twists and turns. And there are sort of chance meetings that you have with people. And this all happened completely out of the blue just over 10 years ago. My wife at the time was working at Musgrave Park Hospital, and one of her colleagues, her father is a GP, who's the trustee of the charity, James Buckle, and he'd been given by one of his patients a box of spectacles to say, for your work in Kenya, have these glasses. And he thought, great, thanks for that. How the heck do you tell who needs what glasses? So how do you match up glasses to people? And so his daughter had said, well, my friend's husband's an optician. I'm sure he could help you. So I got together with James and his wife, Mary, and they came around to my practice. And I gave them a quick masterclass on how to tell if people are long or short-sighted and how to tell if spectacles are for long or short-sightedness. And it was a throwaway comment I made to him on that occasion, which was, if you ever want an optician to come out with you to Kenya, then just let me know. And in November 2007, I was on the plane out in Kenya, the first optometrist that had visited this part of the country. The geography of Kenya is very, very different from the UK. Here, you know if you're driving between Dorset and Somerset or Wiltshire. But over there, the boundaries between the tribal people are quite woolly, quite vague, if you like. And the country is split into about 42 different tribal people. Many of them are fixed geographical locations. Some of them are nomadic. And the Acamba tribe are the fifth largest tribe, which they tend to live around the east of the country, so snaking around the larger parts of Nairobi. And unlike the parts of the west of Kenya, where it rains frequently and there's abundant crops, there's tea and coffee plantations, there's flowers and vegetables, the east, it could readily go 3 years without rain. And that is a big problem at the moment. With the climate change that's happening, we're seeing a lot of change to the rainfall over in that part of the world. And there hasn't been any meaningful rain now for a good 2 years. And that's really hard to get your head around when we live somewhere like the UK where it rains so often and we have an abundance of it. You wish you could pick it up and just drop it over there because these people are dying and it's heartbreaking. So the area that we go to is struck often with famine and drought. And these are people who have no means. They live on the poverty line. Less than a dollar a day, a lot of these people have to exist on. And so we help the people in a number of different ways, whether that is by providing school buildings, whether building water projects. And that was done alongside a sister organisation called the Wishing for a Well Appeal, which many people in the area will know. It was set up by Brian Cooper, a man who now lives in Sherborne. And this was 30 or so years ago. And he and his organisation worked in that region for a long time. sadly, he's not in a position to go out anymore, so we've taken on his work. And the Acambarade Fund was founded by Dennis Cannon and Colin Martin in 1999, doing similar work to complement what Colin was doing. So we've now taken on the water projects, so we build dams and wells. But I suppose the other large part of what we do is the medical side, and that's my personal involvement. So the other trustees of the charity, Trudy and James, are along with me, are the medical people. And we work from a clinic in a really small remote village called Guy, which is out in near a place called Cuso.
Tell me about when you first went there, though. 2007, wasn't it, you say?
Yes, absolutely.
And that must have been a bit of a culture shock.
Oh, completely. I'd never been south of the equator, never been to Kenya, never been to Africa, never been... It was just everything was completely new.
And you've got these literally hundreds of people who are queuing up to see you.
Yeah, and the first day... I'll never forget my first day of working over there, that it was... It was a sudden wake-up call, because I'd gone with this idea that there's only 4 million people that need to be tested. Let's get on with it. Come on, we can do this. We can get through it. And so I started, and the first person, I looked in their eyes and sort of working through translators, trying to find out what the problem is. And, oh, this man's vision's not very good. Okay. So we'll look inside his eye. Oh, it looks like he's got a cataract. I can't see behind the cataract. I'll put some dilating drops in his eyes to have a look, which is what I would do in the UK. And the next person comes in. Oh, I can't see this person's back of his eye. He's got a cataract. Let's put some dilating drops in. And everybody was in exactly the same position. And I had these queues of people, literally hundreds of people waiting outside. And I've got all these people waiting with pupils dilating. I'm like, I can't do this. I absolutely can't do it. And very, very quickly, I realised that I had to change my approach. And rather than going for the excellent quality of care and giving you the best vision that you can get, which is what I have to do in the UK, it was, you can't read the Bible. With these reading glasses, can you read the Bible? Yes, fine, next. And it was firefighting, that's how I would describe it. So all you're doing is dealing with what's your one problem, and does this make that better? Yes, then go, next. And it's like looking for better, not best. And I found that really, really, really hard. So what I've aimed to do over the times that I've been is to develop a better quality of service. And in the past, it would only happen when I was there or my business partner would go. And you would go for 2 weeks, see 100, 150 people a day, and give out as many glasses as you could and come home again. And that might be it for a year or two. So what happened 3 years ago is we did some fundraising to build an eye clinic, which was successful. And in March of this year, I went over to open the eye clinic, and at the same time employed what's called an ophthalmic clinical officer, so an eye specialist, and she's called Jane. She's a wonderful woman, and she works there full-time now. So I'm delighted to know that I can walk away and people are having their eyes tested 5 days a week rather than waiting for that trip that I do every other year. And that's where the next phase of the work that we're doing is coming in, because she's trained to do eye surgery, so cataract surgery, glaucoma surgery, and other quite gruesome operations that you need to do in developing countries if you get eyes that become diseased. And we now need to give her the equipment that she can do that with. So what I organised when I was out there in March is for an eye surgeon to come from Nairobi with a portable operating microscope, and he comes every month or two and supports her to get her experience of doing the surgery. But when he's gone, the operating microscope is gone. So if there's a need to do an operation in between, it simply is not possible. So in the summer, we had an event called the Eye Bash that I put together, which was to raise money for the operating microscope. It had Flatland Boogie Band headlining. It was a great night over in Norton Subhampton. And thanks to the amazing generosity of people in the Southwest, so far we've raised £7,200 towards the microscope. I think an operating microscope is somewhere in the region of about £15,000, so there's still a bit of work to do, but we've got a lot of the way there. And as soon as that's in place, I feel that we'll have an excellent quality of service. What I've been able to do, thanks to connections that I have through the work I do at the hospital, I managed to acquire a slit lamp microscope, which is the microscope, if you've ever had your eyes assessed in the hospital or in one of my practices, it's the microscope that's used to diagnose your eye disease. I managed to acquire one of those, pack it up in my suitcases, take it over in March and put it back together, and it worked, which was quite a miracle. comparing that with the government hospitals, they have a torch and a magnifying glass, and that's how your eyes are assessed over there. So this little remote clinic is this beacon of quality of eye care in the region, and it's on quite well-developed travel routes, so people know this clinic exists, and it's gaining a lot of momentum now. So for me, that's a huge part of my life, and I'm planning my seventh trip to Kenya in March to go over and further develop the service. There's lots still to do. I would love to have a glaucoma monitoring and treatment service. I'd love to have a laboratory so they can make spectacles for people rather than having to take out second-hand glasses. I'd love to be able to give them the facilities to actually glaze the lenses themselves. And that's maybe 5 years away. But the eye clinic itself has the facility for that. There's four clinical rooms that can be used for many different purposes. It has solar-powered heated water. It's even got electricity when the electricity is on. So it's quite an amazing building.
And you have a full-time optometrist out there now working for the fund.
That's right, yeah. The Jane, who's the ophthalmic clinical officer, it's a different sort of qualification from optometry. It's equivalent to a nurse practitioner who has an additional qualification in doing eyes and eye surgery. So she's not a doctor, she's not an optometrist. It's a quite a unique African sort of medical qualification.
But she's well able to deal with the type of daily
Absolutely,
problems
yeah.
that present.
And the problems that they encounter over there, one of the worst that we see is trachoma. It's a horrible disease, which is endemic in certain parts of Kenya. It's always in places with very poor sanitation, and it's caused by chlamydia. And it's simply, if you don't have a proper toilet to use, then if you just go and do what you need to do around the back of your home, then the flies get their sustenance from there. They spread the chlamydia from that onto your eye as they're having a drink of your tears, and then leave the chlamydia in your eye. You get a horrible sticky infection, and then it causes scarring of your eyelid. Your eyes get scratched by your eyelashes and you end up losing your sight. It's a horrible, horrible disease, treated with an ointment that costs about 10p for a tube. It's wrong that still happens in this day.
The striking thing about so many of these third world countries is that quite trivial sums of money make a huge difference, don't they?
They do indeed. And it's this whole concept of teaching a man to fish and he can feed himself forever. And that's what we try to do. With all the work that we do, we're giving people the means to do the work themselves rather than doing it for them, because that isn't a helpful thing. And with going back to what we were saying about Jane and her work, she is there full time. She's not employed by the charity. She's actually employed by Robert Frith Optometrists. And that's something that was important for me to do, because funding in places like Kenya can be quite sporadic. There might be some money that comes from the government for a particular project. They can employ staff, and when that budget goes, the staff have to go. And I could not bear to think of my beautiful eye clinic just being left empty. So we have to effectively support her salary from the UK. But knowing that we can do that, I think is a great service that we can offer these people who have such need.
And you need another £7,000-8,000 then for this particular
piece of equipment. This particular microscope, absolutely. And so there's many other projects that the cataract surgery itself, there's a cost associated with that. But it's £45 for a cataract operation. That's all it costs, and it is hard to put that sort of sum into context, really, because over here
it would cost many times that.
You'd be looking at probably £2,000-2,500 for a cataract operation. It's that sort of equivalence, I suppose. If you had no money and you survived on the money you could get from the extra vegetables that you can grow from your homestead, trying to find £45 would take you years. And that's where we come in. We support them by providing their eye care and health care.
And you're a trustee of the Akamba Aid Fund now, Jude. So if anybody wishes to make a donation, listening to this today,
they'd be very
drop
very
it
welcomed.
Into your practice.
Well, absolutely. All the team at my practices know all about my charity work. They get given lots of strange things, whether it's checks, whether it's bags of glasses or medical equipment. But the charity has a website. It's akambaaidfund.org. And there's all the information about the work that we do over there, from the medical work and all the other things that we do besides.
Excellent. Simon, I think we've come probably to a natural conclusion. At this point, before we take your final track, I always ask people what their hobbies are, and what, obviously yours is music, largely dominated, isn't it?
Absolutely. But, yes.
Any other interesting pursuits? You obviously were a geek, so...
Oh, a complete geek, yes.
So do you still collect train numbers?
No, I've moved on from that. No, I love the fact that I can be paid to be a geek, because so much of my work is geek-related. I'm a very keen photographer. I don't know how good I am at doing it. I don't get much time to do it. But no, the biggest thing I do is I'm a dad. I'm very proud to have two beautiful girls who are themselves musical. Lucy is learning clarinet and piano, and Sophie is hitting the pots and pans, learning the drums. And it's really just to future-proof the family band, really. If my dad can't do it anymore, I've got to get someone else in to do it. So Sophie's the next one.
I see. Okay. Right, Simon, it's been a great pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much
for
coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're going to take your final track, and I'm going to leave you to introduce this one because it's full of African names, which I may struggle with.
Well, I decided to choose this one because it's so reminiscent of my trips over to Kenya. This song is by a man called Ken Wambwa Wa Maria, and the song is called Kayori Yori Kakwa. And it is, if I close my eyes, I could be walking through Kuso Market at the moment. It's very, very evocative indeed.
Simon, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Nina wana kayori yori kakwa Kana frida wangike nesa Nina wana kayori yori kakwa Africa when we can essa Kamurembo Keno ya kayori yori kakwa Mwito musoka ni vata nako Keno ya kayori yori kakwa Tumusoka ni vata naku Inaranya maisha ni makwa Nunda kweza yuewe wakwa Inaranya maisha ni makwa Nakwenda yuwe we wapa Kamuremba Nenozo wa lunch kwanza tauni Koko kwa taba mwena chipo Nenozo wa lunch kwanza tauni Koko kwa taba mwena chipo
Alvaro
Kwaya chivo tumetauni tuende Urupaka kukwe matalo Kwaya chivo tumetauni tuende Urupaka kukwe matalo Kumoekale kumatu na kuwekale kelemasi
wewe na mizigo wakwaku kono wazako kele mazi Ewe na mizigo wakwaku kono wazako kele mazi
Yoyata
Iria wanda nera Saimo kai siname sana
Apple